Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on homeschool when we return. In 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." That clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. In 1965, Congress said that there was no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and the value of clad coin or currency. And you know that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, did you know there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper and a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money as opposed to gold coin? Now, you know, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin in our Constitution for no good purpose. They knew, and they knew as a matter of law, the gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress, neither did our politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. And that's because those politicians knew, and they knew full well back in 1933 when they did it, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to property and to destroy those property rights. And that's accomplished by the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now, let me teach you how to do just that. And this is in my business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home school. If you'd like more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Remember, my business school is available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of public school versus homeschool, and I showed you that homeschool is not only big, it's getting bigger. Big and getting bigger. Back in the 1980s, it was minuscule. 1980, probably a few thousand. By 1990, it was pushing a million. By 2000, it was 2 million. Today, in 2005, it's pushing 3 million American children are being educated in homeschool. And the latest numbers that I saw was that they're scoring at the 86th percentile, 86, 87, along in there. Private schools around 80, 81, 82, 82nd percentile. Public school, 50th percentile. Inner city public schools, 28th percentile. Get this. The most expensive education that you can derive in America is public school at $7,000 on average nationwide. $14,000 up for inner-city public schools, $2,500 to $3,500 a year in a private school, and $600 a year in a home school, which fits just exactly what we took a look at last week when we were talking about poison drops in the federal Senate. Zach Montgomery said the more money you spend on public education, the poorer the quality of student. And there's just exactly what he said in 1886 is true today in the year 2005. Just exactly what he said was going on in 1886 is going on today. The more money you spend on children in public school, the dumber they get. The poorer their academic performance. If you want to cut the academic performance in half, if you want to dumb American children down even more than they are today, double the amount of money that you spend on them in public school, and that will guaranteed accomplish that goal. And every time that there is a complaint about educational excellence in public school, the solution is spend more money. The answer to that is spend less money. The less money you spend on education, the better the academic performance, as is illustrated by the homeschool movement. But it's worse than that. The story, as we progress along and learn more, gets worse and worse as we go forward. Have you heard about literacy? You know, we talk a lot about being able to read and write, don't we? Literacy. Now, we see ourselves in America as being a literate nation. This is a first world nation. This is not a third world backward retarded nation like India or Afghanistan or Iran. This is a first class, first rate nation. Well, listen to this from David W. Kirkpatrick. He is a senior education fellow at the U.S. Freedom Foundation. And he wrote a short treatise here. It comes out every week. If you'd like to subscribe to it, go to www.freedomfoundation.us. How's that? freedomfoundation.us. And you're looking for David W. Kirkpatrick, spelled K-I-R-K-P-A-T-R-I-C-K. Listen to this. Literacy, then and now. Report number 695. Some weeks ago, a commentary cited evidence that literacy rates in the United States were higher years ago than they are today. In fact, literacy was higher in the colonial period than it is today. And some recipients not only found this interesting, but new information. Some asked for further data. So here it is. This is in response to those inquiries. And only the surface may be skimmed, especially where so much evidence is available. Number one. A leading source is the late British-born economist E.G. West. West was born in 1922. He died in 2001. West's best-known work may be Education and the State, which was published in 1965. It has been republished since. A specific article on literacy is this. It says, quote, "The spread of education before compulsion, Britain and America in the 19th century, published by the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE, F-E-E, in July of 1996. West's work continues to be very significant. Among those influenced have been Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman, for instance, and British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Milton Friedman began to question public education after reading West's book, and Prime Minister Thatcher was persuaded to adopt major educational reforms of the British public education system as a result of West's books. This included legislation in 1988 that, among other things, created grant-maintained schools in Great Britain, somewhat analogous to the charter school movement, which began in the United States with legislation in Minnesota in 1991. If you go to google.com, search for E.G. West will bring up something like 32,000 sites. Adding the word literacy narrows it down a bit to 7,000 sites. And there's also an E.G. West Center, which continues his work to this day. Its website is www.ncl.ac.uk/EG West. Now, in his fee article, West noted evidence that from 1650 to 1795, literacy among American males was as high as 90%. From 1800 to 1840, it rose as high as 97% in the North and 81% in the South. As public schooling was getting underway after 1834, literacy in Massachusetts was as high as 98%. Now, that compares to 91% in Massachusetts today, which still may be the highest literacy rate in the nation. Now, if you've got a pencil and paper out there, boys and girls, write this down. Massachusetts, the literacy rate was 98% in 1834 and 91% in 2005. It still has the highest literacy rate in America today, but it slipped 7 percentage points. Nor was West alone. Neil Postman, who has written widely on education in his Building a Bridge to the 18th Century, published in 1999, said that the literacy rate in Massachusetts and Connecticut from 1640 to 1700 was as high as 95% for men and 62% for women, even though women received very little formal education at the time. So take a look again. Here's a second source. Neil Postman published a book called Building a Bridge to the 18th Century, published in 1999, said the literacy rate in Massachusetts and Connecticut from 1640 to 1700, a 60-year period, was 95% for men, 62% for women, even though women received very little formal education. Now, John Taylor Gatto, multiple choice as Teacher of the Year in both New York City and New York State, who is also an education historian, in his book, Dumbing Us Down, 1992. Said a fifth grade math or rhetoric textbook in 1850 was written at what would be considered college level today. Now that's John Taylor Gatto. He was the multiple choice Teacher of the Year in New York City and New York State. He also was an education historian. He wrote a book in 1992, and he said in that book, fifth grade math or rhetoric textbook in 1850 was written at what we would call college level today. So you have to go to college today to get the education that you would have gotten in 1850 in the United States. Best-selling historian David McCullough, whose most recent book is 1776. It's another knowledgeable source who said that the literacy rate in Massachusetts was higher in 1798 than it is today in 2005. One reason why the literacy rate was so much higher then, he adds, was nearly everybody read the Bible. Everybody read the Bible. And because everybody read the Bible or learned to read the Bible, everybody was literate. When we threw the Bible out of public school, when we took the Bible out of our public institutions, I think we did ourselves a great disservice. Now, sadly, one need not go back 200 years. Just in 1900, just 100 years ago, only 10.7% of Americans were functionally illiterate. That is, they could not read or write a simple message in any language. By 1993, that percentage had doubled to 20.7%, this when compulsory schooling became virtually universal. Now listen to this again. In 1900, the illiteracy rate was 10% in America. Today, it's 20%. In 105 years, the illiteracy rate has doubled. And we spend more money on public education than any other format in education. Far more, 10 times more than in homeschool, 4 times more than private private school. And as a result of it, our illiteracy rate has doubled. During World War II, notes educator John Silber, 9% of the inductees were illiterate. By 1964, it was 20% were marginally literate. In 1950, the overall literacy rate was estimated at 97%. But less than 50 years later, in 1996, the literacy rate had slipped. It declined to less than 80%. 2 years later, in 1998, Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, in his books titled Kids Who Kill, stated that as many as 90 million American adults are illiterate, and another 35 million Americans can only read simple material with difficulty. Less than 3 years ago, September 16, 2002, Peter Jennings on the ABC TV Evening News reported that 50 million Americans read at or below the fifth grade level. Now, effective democracy requires an educated citizenry. Now, as the educated citizenry declines, then the effective democracy is at risk. Not only has literacy among Americans been declining for centuries, it has continued, perhaps accelerated, since the introduction of public school in the 1830s. The relationship of such schooling with literacy seems to be inversely proportional. The more public school that we have, the more illiteracy we create. And as the former increases, the latter decreases. As we have more and more import by the public school system, we have greater and greater illiteracy. Now, reversing such a long-term trend will be difficult at best, but 170 years of history would seem to show us that it will not be done by the present compulsory government-controlled school system. It'll have to be done in private school and home school. Now, that's report number 695, Literacy Then and Now, by David W. Kirkpatrick, U.S. Freedom Foundation, www.freedomfoundation.us. Subject is Literacy Then and Now. Kirkpatrick puts out a paper every week. In school report number 680, called Teacher Certification, David W. Kirkpatrick of the U.S. Freedom Foundation can be reached at www.freedomfoundation.us. Teacher certification does not guarantee competency. Now, proposals for alternative teacher certification usually arouse the ire of the teachers' unions. There is much rhetoric about the need for qualified teachers, and studies say that teachers know and can do, and it's very important, as if anyone or anyone disagrees with that statement. But to say teacher knowledge and skills are important doesn't make the case for the present certification system here in America. For decades now, studies of traditional certification have found that the certification system today is totally ineffective. Even the late Al Shanker, president of the American Federation of Teachers, said it screens out many who would be superb teachers. A USA Today survey some years ago found almost half of the National Teachers of the Year felt their preparation was inadequate. On the same weekend, delegates to a state teachers' convention were rhapsodizing about high academic and performance standards. A Pittsburgh Post-Gazette article was noting a comment by Richard Mitchell, author of Underground Grammarian and a former English teacher at a New Jersey teachers' college. He recalled the final exam in an education course gave 52% of the grade for being able to draw all of the letters of the alphabet, both upper and lower case. Now, there's a high standard to follow. Now, let me repeat that. I don't want you to miss it. And the fellow by the name of, let's see if I got his name here, Al Shanker, was the president of the American Federation of Teachers. And he said that the American Federation of Teachers, or to their convention, that the certification process screens out, eliminates, does away with, obliterates many who would be superb teachers. So the system is designed to weed out superb teachers. We don't want superb teachers, we want mediocrity at best. Now, a second quote, a USA Today survey some years ago found almost half of the national teachers of the year felt that their preparation was inadequate. So of the best teachers that win the National Teacher of the Year award, half of them, 50%, don't believe that they were adequately prepared to teach school. On the same weekend, delegates to a state teachers convention were rhapsodizing about high academic performance standards. And here's a citation or a quotation from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette article. And they noted a comment by Richard Mitchell. Richard Mitchell was the author of Underground Grammarian, and he was a former English teacher at a New Jersey teachers college. Now here's what Richard Mitchell said in the article. He recalled the final exam in an education course. Now here's a teacher in a teacher's college, and he's reporting to us that in the teacher's final exam, here's what your teacher of grammar, your English teacher of your child in public school, here's his standard. The final exam course gave a 52% of the grade for being able to draw all of the letters of the alphabet, both upper and lower case. Now let me tell you, boys and girls, when I was a little kid, this would be in 1945, little Georgie Gordon was in the second grade. Second grade! Now, little Georgie in the Marshall School, Eureka, California. And little Georgie at age 7 could draw all of the letters of the alphabet in both upper and lower case. Second grade. Now that's the standard that your English teacher has to meet. Well, half of the standard, 52%. So says this teacher from an English class or English school that teaches. This is a teacher's college. I mean, come on, boys and girls, surely we can draw the alphabet in upper and lower case, can't we? Nor consider this story. John Corcoran, in his 1994 book, The Teacher Who Couldn't Read, said that he was a high school teacher for over 20 years, even though he was illiterate until he was age 48. The New York Post, among others, has given prime examples of writings by Brooklyn teachers. One teacher in Brooklyn, concerned about one of her second graders, wrote this statement, quote, "How comes his past teachers have been passing him from grade to grade without he advancing or progressing academically?" And that's spelled A-C-A-D-E-M-I-C-L-Y. "I would like to know what is causing the mental blockage," unquote. Did you get that? Let me read that to you again. You're going to love this. This is a teacher in Brooklyn, New York. This is cited in the New York Post. It was cited in other publications, but the New York Post is where this comes from. And this is a teacher concerned about one of her second grade students, I should say. And she wrote, quote, "How comes his past teachers have been passing him from grade to grade without he advancing or progressing academically?" Academically, A-C-A-D-E-M-I-C-L-Y. "I would like to know what is causing the mental blockage, unquote. Now, or how about this? Here's a quotation. Right now, teacher certification procedures are a joke. They don't distinguish between those who can and those who cannot teach, unquote. That was Arthur Wise as he was being inaugurated president of the National Council for Accreditation of Teacher Educators, called NCATE. Arthur Wise. He asked this question, or he's made this statement. I guess he should make this statement. He says, right now, teacher certification procedures are a joke. They don't distinguish between those who can and those who cannot teach. Where was he quoted? Well, he was quoted in the NEA Today, April 1991. Now, the NEA is the National Education Association. It's their newsletter. It's the NEA Today, April 1991. Delegates should read their own union publication. Wise might have a different view today. It certainly would be embarrassing for him to say no progress has been made in 14 years. One national survey of 4,000 public school teachers cited by the New York Times. This is the New York Times. They found only 1 in 5 believe that they are well qualified to teach in a modern classroom. Did you get that? Here's 4,000 public school teachers cited by the New York Times. They found that only 1 in 5 believe that they were well qualified to teach in a modern classroom. 20%. Now, if that's true, that could be a growing problem as the National Child Left Behind Act, NCLB, no President Bush's No Child Left Behind story, contains a requirement that teachers become highly qualified, which one would assume is roughly equivalent to being well qualified. Well, now, in this No Child Left Behind program, passed by Congress, promoted by the President and the Department of Education in Washington, D.C., calls for or requires that the teachers be highly qualified or well qualified, and only 1 out of 5 teachers that were interviewed or cited by the New York Times found only 1 in 5 believed that he was well qualified. Now, that's 800 out of 4,000. Only 800 teachers. 3,200 of them said, no, I'm not qualified. Well, that's a big job. We've got to qualify 3,200 teachers. Now, this is an admission by the teachers themselves, boys and girls. And that is that 80% of the teachers in New York said, we're not qualified to teach in a modern classroom. Now, if they're not qualified, what would make you as a parent believe that you are unqualified? I mean, let's face it, you're a truck driver or a housewife and you don't have a teaching credential. You haven't been to college. You haven't been certified. Well, shucks, one guy, John Corcoran, said in his 1994 book that he couldn't read until he was 48 after he'd been teaching school for 20 years. Here was a guy who was an illiterate teaching public school for 20 years. Now, how can you get more incompetent than an illiterate teaching school? I mean, hell, if you were an illiterate, you couldn't be any worse than that teacher was for 40 or 20 years. Finally, one day he woke up and said, well, gosh, I guess maybe I'm doing a disservice to my students. Maybe I should learn how to read. And he did. The Washington Post cited another study which found at least 1 of every 5 public school teachers has neither a major nor a minor in the subject that they're teaching. Another NCLB requirement. No Child Left Behind. And here are these teachers. Now get the numbers here. 1 out of every 5. That's 20% of the teachers doesn't have a major or a minor in the subject they're teaching. So here's a guy goes to college. Maybe his major is English and his minor is science and he's teaching PE. Or maybe he's a PE teacher. That's what his major was in college, but now he's teaching English or math. 20%. Not qualified. Another Shanker comment was that at least 25% of teachers are not qualified to be in the classroom. Now, who was this guy Shanker? Well, he was the president of the American Federation of Teachers. He said 25% of the teachers are not qualified to be in the classroom. Well, that's the bad news. The good news is 75% of the teachers are competent. That's good news. Now, how do you know that your kid's being taught by one of the 75% of the competent teachers? And by the way, all 100% of the teachers that are teaching in the public schools are college graduates, been to teaching school, have a teaching credential. I mean, these people are certified, competent teachers. Hang on a minute. Let me give you an interruption here. And then we'll be back with more from David W. Kirkpatrick. You're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through that same website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order your free introductory CD package, please call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review necessarily, and those publications may not endorse the Law Hour and Editorial Review necessarily. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, just go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at area code 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing Senior Education Fellow David W. Kirkpatrick of the U.S. Freedom Foundation, School Report Number 680 on Teacher Certification. Teacher certification doesn't guarantee competency. Our last statement before we took our break, the Washington Post cited another study which found at least one of every five public school teachers has neither a major nor a minor in the subject that they're teaching, another NCLB requirement. Another Shanker comment was that at least 25% of teachers are not qualified to be in the classroom. 25% not qualified to be in the classroom, and they all have credentials, letters after their names, and certification. Connecticut, New Jersey, and Texas have a program which permits alternative certification in all academic subjects and at all grade levels. About 20% of New Jersey's teachers qualify for their teacher certificate this way. Officials report that teacher quality has improved, the number of minority applicants has doubled, and non-traditional applicants scored higher on the national teacher examinations. In the first year, new hires included a Fulbright scholar, 5 Harvard graduates, and a scientist with 2 patents to his credit. Evaluators concluded that those who moved into teaching from other careers were in fact better teachers and better role models because they were more mature and they had more varied life experiences. Nor is New Jersey alone in its findings. Texas found absolutely no difference in the quality between teachers with education degrees and those teachers who do not have education degrees. And California concluded that properly certified teachers were no better than those with alternative certification or even those with emergency certificates. Now, it also became easier to obtain teachers to fill the sometimes critical shortage of teachers in science and math classes. All of which and much more is ignored by the teacher union activists. These unthinking teacher activists support and their support of ineffective or mediocre approaches just because their traditional reflects very little credit to themselves and does no favor to exemplary public classroom teachers who may be identified with less than stellar colleagues, since there is virtually no reliable research establishing a causal link between any program of teacher training and student achievement gains. State regulators have little basis for regulating teacher training programs. Michael Podursky, Improving Academic Performance in U.S. Schools, in a paper prepared for the American Enterprise Institute conference in Washington, D.C., October the 18th through the 20th, 2003. This report is School Report number 680, Teacher Certification, written by David W. Kirkpatrick of the U.S. Freedom Foundation. He's a senior education fellow. You can get to their website at www.freedomfoundation.us. Again, that's www.freedomfoundation.us. U.S. That Freedom Foundation is all one word. The email address for David W. Kirkpatrick is K-I-R-K-D-W. It's just Kirk with his initials, just like you'd put it into an alphabetized list. K-I-R-K-D-W at AOL.com. Kirk D-W. At AOL.com. That report was number 680. But he's not through. He also wrote a piece on ineffective schooling. Remember, this is David W. Kirkpatrick. Kirkpatrick. And it's spelled K-I-R-K-P-A-T-R-I-C-K. U.S. Freedom Foundation Senior Education Fellow. Remember, that's www.freedomfoundation.us, Effective Schooling, School Report number 698. School Report number 698. Listen to this. Perhaps the day will come when we stop trying to teach students things they don't need to know, things they already know, and things that they cannot be effectively taught in school anyway. As just one example, the typical high school curriculum still follows an outline created back in 1918 by a private committee. It can be well argued that this didn't make any sense then, and it makes even less sense now. That education outline created back in 1918, was structured to lead into a college education when most students did not even reach high school, much less college. Nor did these students graduate from high school. That curriculum was, and is today, largely irrelevant, except that it creates jobs for the providers of the curriculum. It's a make-work program, like WPA. For example, how much use does the average person, even a very competent person today, have for chemistry, physics, foreign language, or quadratic equations? Now, these are extremely useful for some individuals in some circumstances, but for the average Joe Sixpack citizen, how much sense does it make to take chemistry, physics, foreign language, or quadratic equations? Brief exposure to math and science concepts or survey courses makes sense because it gives students an idea of something that they might be interested in and or for which they have a talent. But to require every student to take years of math, years of science, or years of foreign languages serves little or no purpose whatsoever. It is inordinately expensive. It is not only wasteful from the point of view of the taxpayers, but should be rightly regarded as harmful to the students and many educators as well. Because money wasted is money that should not be spent. It is also money that is not available for things that need to be done. Now, given the above, we may move away from school districts and school boards not because of bad people, but because it is a bad system. It has never worked. It does not work now, and it cannot be made to work in the future. Just take a simple, controversial example, like sex education. When that idea, sex education, is proposed, a school board can either vote to place it in the curriculum or not. Either way, lots of people are unhappy. Very unhappy. If they vote for it, they discover that even many advocates of sex education will be unhappy because it doesn't go far enough. At what grade level should it be introduced? What should be presented at each grade level? Is sex education taught in mixed classes or separately to boys and to girls? How explicit should this sex education be in public schools? Are condoms distributed in these classes? And should they be? How about homosexuality? And on the controversy goes. And that's just one topic, sex education. If all of these Solomon problems were solved, where is the staff going to be found that can knowledgeably, sensitively, and effectively teach this kind of material? Which is why, aside from morality issues or ideological stands, it can be argued that the schools cannot teach sex education. The public schools should not teach sex education, and if they try, they are as likely to do harm as they are to do good. And as for what might remain the same in basic education, there are a few things that they are mostly at the macro education level, not the micro education level. Foremost is the fact that despite those who would separate school and state, there is a national group with that as their title. Education will continue to be primarily funded with public dollars, although the amount and the distribution system may be quite different from today. There will continue to be students and teachers, but their relationship may be considerably different and, with luck, better than today. Most of what is currently done is inefficient, ineffective, needlessly expensive and educationally irrational, if not irresponsible. And this is not to deny that it is rational on any other grounds. It benefits those who are employed by the system. It keeps public school teachers and administrators off the streets and out of the pool halls and occupied as babysitters for your children. It keeps youngsters off the job market, which is one of the reasons for compulsory attendance, which was promoted by labor unions back in the 1930s, among others. And it provides, particularly at the younger ages, a much-needed babysitting service. Babysitting service. Now, one reason many parents are supportive of the public school system is that it is a public-funded babysitting service, even when it fails to adequately educate their children. Now, these benefits are not illusory or minor in their impact. They're among the reasons why school reform has been so slow, despite generations of school reform effort, and why the opposition is so vigorous in their opposition to any reform of the public schools. But the limitations and faults of the present public school system are increasingly and glaringly obvious, except to those who will not see. And working alternatives and variations are increasingly numerous and patently successful. And that progress toward a better system is at last underway and perhaps even building momentum. Only two kids enjoy high school. One is the captain of the football team, and the other is his girlfriend. So says a letter to columnist Ann Landers. All right, now that is an essay, or a short report, number 698 on effective schooling, written by David W. Kirkpatrick of the U.S. Freedom Foundation. Now, this report comes to our news desk every week. I don't know what the price of it is. It may be free. Why don't you get this newsletter, this essay, this report every week? This particular report, Effective Schooling, is School Report 698. David W. Kirkpatrick is a senior education fellow at the U.S. Freedom Foundation. Their website is www.freedomfoundation.us. Freedom Foundation is all one word. And this Kirkpatrick, David W. Kirkpatrick, has an email address. It's KIRKDW. It's easy enough. KirkDW, KIRKDW@AOL.com. Let's take a look at one more before we leave the air. And this one is on Catch-22, Educational Catch-22, School Report number 698. David W. Kirkpatrick, U.S. Freedom Foundation, www.freedomfoundation.us, all one word, freedomfoundation.us. Playing education catch-up. You know, parents have always had a constitutional right to determine how and where their children will be educated. That's a right that was made clear by a unanimous U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1925. Did you get that? 1925. You, parents, you have the constitutional right to determine how and where your children will be educated. There are three places. Public school, private school, and home school. You make the choice. So all of you that are sending your children to public school and say, well, it's the law and I have no choice, you're dead wrong. Dead. D-E-D. Dead wrong. What remains unresolved is how to make it affordable for all parents, not just those with the personal resources to exercise this right by sending their children to expensive private schools. There is, however, no single approach or model legislation to accomplish this end. Just as no two states have the same school code or the same charter school law, it is neither necessary nor likely that they will adopt identical school choice laws. Among both proponents and opponents of school choice, there are those who in good conscience bring forth questions or concerns that can usually be resolved when all of the parties act in good faith. But there are also opponents. These opponents raise objections with absolutely no intention of seeing these objections met or arriving at a workable compromise. These opponents shift ground as necessary and often attack a school choice proposal precisely because it does in fact meet an earlier objection of theirs. These are usually public school teachers or the National Education Association or some other affiliated union or some other group, organization, or association that has a financial interest in the mediocrity of the existing public school system. These opponents fight furiously against any school choice legislation that's being enacted. This would be a questionable position even if it was sincerely held. However, failing to defeat school choice legislation, as is increasingly the case around the nation, their fallback position is to cripple it and to make it totally unworkable, or to limit this school choice to the fewest possible students and then the fewest dollars to be spent on each grant. While these measures are extreme, these can be legitimate positions. But what is not legitimate is to insist upon limiting legislative proposals and then cry these big crocodile tears for the students who will allegedly be left behind, which says something about their own view of these public schools. Because if these public schools are leaving these children behind, it's because the public schools aren't fit to send those children who are going to be left behind to in the first place. And or that these grants are so small that the students receiving them can afford only limited availability. Well, in short, no matter what plan is being offered, the opposition opposes it. If it is a general program, catch 22 opponents condemn it as being too big and too expensive. Yet, if the program is limited, it's then charged with helping only a few, leaving others behind, and giving the recipients too few dollars. Now, if these opponents were in fact sincere, and if all of these objections were sincerely made, the solution is simple. Just make school choice available to every student, period. And then provide the funding at the per pupil level currently being spent in that public school. Just take the amount of money that's now being spent in that public school, $7,000, $14,000, $21,000 a year per student, and give it to the parents and let them choose what school they want to send their child to. And then let them pocket the difference and take that kid to Disneyland. This has been done successfully for generations in Vermont, where some districts do not operate schools but provide grants that may equal the statewide average per pupil of spending. Not only that, in Vermont, if the local citizens agree in a town meeting, as has happened, the grant can be for whatever amount the voters approve. No one's left behind, and a wide variety of options are utilized, not only in and out of the state, but out of the nation as well. Students have attended schools as far away as Paris and Finland with the tuition, not the travel expenses, but the tuition paid by their local Vermont government. Now, up in Vermont, they have real choice. Not an echo, a real choice. Now, nationally, hundreds of different school choice proposals have been introduced in the 50 state legislatures and Congress. Adamant opponents have objected to every single one without exception. These are not serious people. They are hypocrites. They are hypocritical obstructionists, and increasingly they're being recognized as just that, Opponents have one major and one insurmountable problem. They must win every time. Where school choice programs are inaugurated, they are not later repealed. To the contrary, once school choice becomes the law, once their success is obvious, they tend to be expanded. Exemplifying the fact that no two choice laws need to be the same, they're appearing in more variations. Some are straight vouchers, student grants. Some are for students from families with incomes below stipulated levels. Others are special education students or for students from schools where students have low achievement rates. A more recent variation now existing in several states is a universal tuition tax credit program with credits against personal or corporate incomes for contributions to student scholarship organizations. The most rapidly growing version is the charter school movement. Where there were no such schools in 1991, now there are more than 3,300 charter schools enrolling nearly 1 million students nationwide. School choice will continue to move forward, and the opponents to school choice will be left by the wayside. If a school is not good enough for every child, it is not good enough for any child. Schools have become a major threat to learning. Professional educators have become a major threat to education. And young people now need to be protected from these compulsory schools. That's page 178, Robert F. Bundy, Accountability, A New Disneyland Fantasy. Phi Delta Kaplan, November 1974. If you'd like a report, or any one of these reports, this is report number 698, Educational Catch-22, written by David W. Kirkpatrick, U.S. Freedom Foundation, Senior Education Fellow. The website is www.freedomfoundation.us. Freedom Foundation is all one word. Now, the email address for David W. Kirkpatrick is Kirk DW, that's K-I-R-K-D-W, at AOL.com. Kirk DW at AOL.com. Remember, that's David W. Kirkpatrick. This is School Report number 698. Now, he publishes one of these every week. So in this program, I shared with you the views of an educator. I'm an educator, and I have my views. And remember, I said before that maybe Mr. Kirkpatrick doesn't share the same views that I do, but I do share his views in these four essays. In fact, I've probably read 50 of his essays, and I agreed with all of them. I didn't find any problems with any of them. But you may. But just because you find a questionable position that Mr. Kirkpatrick takes, pay attention. You may well agree with some, if not most, or possibly even all that he has to offer. All right, we're just about out of time, boys and girls. We got to leave it right there. So let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet, in more than 75 countries worldwide. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Time's up. Gotta leave. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.